and welcome to this edition of The Assault on Public Education. I'm Cheryl. Today on the show, I'm joined by Morna McDermott and Jonathan Pelto. Jonathan Pelto, who runs the blog Wait, What?, will be joining us a little later in the show. Morna McDermott has been working in with and around public schools for over 20 years. She is one of the original organizers of United Opt Out, the movement to end corporate education reform. United Opt Out National serves as a focused point of unyielding resistance to corporate education reform. It demands an equitably funded, democratically based, anti-racist, desegregated public school system for all Americans that prepares students to exercise compassionate and critical decision-making with civic virtue. And she is currently an associate professor at Towson University in Maryland. She has published numerous papers on the issues of democracy, art, and social justice, including the book, The Left-Handed Curriculum, Creative Experiences for Empowering Teachers. Morna McDermott, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Could you please tell our listening audience a little bit about your background and what got you interested in opposing the Common Core State Standards and being part of the United Opt Out?
Absolutely. I've been an educator for almost 25 years now. I started in about 1989, and it's 2014, and 10 of those years was a K-12 classroom teacher in special ed and also in regular education. And the last 14 years have been working in higher education in colleges of education. I'm also the parent of a 7-year-old and a 9-year-old. Therefore, my initial interest in or concerns about high-stakes standardized testing and Common Core started as an educator, and that influences me profoundly. But I also come at this as a parent who's watching their children experience this on a personal level, watching my friends and their children experience this on a personal level. So I'm motivated from both sides of the fence there.
And tell us a little bit about the Common Core state standards and then the high-stakes testing attached to that and why you disagree with those.
Okay. Well, Common Core was formed by three different organizations. ACHIEVE, which is a nonprofit organization that was co-founded by Lou Gerstner, who was the former CEO of IBM and just a corporate powerhouse. The National Governors Association, which is involved with various facets of state-run economic and education policies, and the Chief Council of State School Officers, which involves state-level school superintendents, educational advisors, and whatnot. And the three of them have worked over the last few decades. I mean, this didn't just spring forth in 2008 out of nowhere, but have spent the last few decades trying to form together their vision for national standards. And Lou Gerstner and David Coleman and Gene Wilhoit, who work within those three different organizations, went to the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation to appeal to Bill Gates for the funding to basically build the Common Core, and that's where it goes forward. Therefore, any place that you see the promotion of Common Core state standards from different websites or textbooks or online companies that help promote Common Core, even the national PTA organizations and even some facets of our national unions, you see funding from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. They really have driven the marketing and the funding behind this in recent years. Furthermore, the Common Core has been found to be developmentally inappropriate, especially for younger grades. This is in part because the standards themselves were not written by educators. They had a validation committee that involved professors and classroom teachers, but there's a lot of debate over how much influence or input those validation committees really had. But if you look at who actually wrote them, what you find are corporations and individuals from Student Achievement Partners, which was founded by David Coleman, who's now the president of College Board. You find people from ETS, the testing company, ACT, the testing company, ACHIEVE, the nonprofit organization I just mentioned, and in a small handful of others. So there were not educators determining what would be in the standards. You had corporations and testing companies determining what would be in the standards. And that makes sense when you see who's profiting from and who was motivated to create this in the first place. It was corporations and testing companies. Furthermore, it constricts what can be experienced in the classroom because of the pressure for accountability, attaching it to these tests. When people are worried about what's in the Common Core, I say what you really need to be worried about is what's in PARC or what's in SBAC. I think is Connecticut an SBAC state or a park state, the new test?
It's an SBAC.
All right, so then what you need to be worried about is what's in the SBAC, because that's really what's going to drive instruction. If there's anything redeeming in the Common Core, if it's not in the tests, you're not going to see it practiced in classrooms anyway. Also, because of the accountability being attached to the high-stakes test, it's going to be tied to student promotion and teacher evaluations. The anxiety levels around what's going to happen in the classrooms is going to be ramped up even worse than it was in No Child Left Behind, if that's even imaginable. We're going to see more stress on the shoulders of children who know that their teachers, you know, careers are going to be made or broken on the shoulders of how well they do on this test. Furthermore, Common Core is interwoven directly with online edutech companies. If you go back and you look at who lobbied for Common Core state standards, if you look at who's been pushing this for the last few decades, it's K-12 Inc., which is the world's largest online testing, or not online education company. It's Pearson, who has the lion's share of the tests attached to Common Core state standards. It's these technology companies that have education arms that see the delivery of education via the Internet, you know, data mining via the Internet, as a boon to their profitability.
So this is all being forced on the public schools across the country, correct, by the race to the top dollars? So if states don't have a lot of choice whether they want to get in this or not?
Right, right. And that's another thing to mention. Common Core is part and parcel of a bundle package. So if you're a race to the top state, and I'm in Maryland, so we're a race to the top state, there are a few things that states had to agree to in order to receive the race to the top federal funding. One was they had to agree to new teacher evaluations. They had to agree to new student evaluations, and that's where you're an SBAC state, I'm a park state. You had to agree to a new curriculum, which is the Common Core. You had to agree to new policies put in place that would open the doors for charter schools and shuttering, quote-unquote, low-performing public schools. So for, you know, Hartford, for any of your urban districts, this is a huge matter, because in states like New York, they've already determined that students that were performing at a level of proficiency with the new Common Core affiliated test, which for New York would be a park test, they had a huge drop in the proficiency of their children. So did these children suddenly get stupider? You know, I doubt it. There's something else at play. They've raised the bar so high that students who historically will not perform well on high-stakes standardized tests, so students of color who are living below the poverty level, students who are English language learners, students with special needs, these are all subgroups that we know historically don't perform well on standardized tests, are going to most likely perform even more poorly on these new standardized tests. Now, if you attach that to, well, if the school doesn't perform at a proficiency, we're going to close it and open it as a charter school, you're going to see public education in the cities in Connecticut bulldozed. You're going to see them shuttered and opened as for-profit, privately run, and a lot of them online, charter schools.
And let me ask you, because we're already seeing that, it's already in process here, but let me ask you, the Common Core state standards, are they based on research? Have they proven themselves that they do what they say they're going to do?
No. They rely on advertising, not research. I mean, this is marketing. This is brilliant, brilliant marketing. The Common Core state standards had never been tried out prior to launching them like a missile across the 50 states, and I think initially they had 44 compelled into its adoption. A few have rolled back since then. But they've never been tried out. We never knew, are these really better? You know, they say, oh, well, these are going to make kids career and college ready. Well, just because you say that doesn't make it true. I mean, I could run around saying I'm Miss America, that doesn't make it true. So they've relied on marketing to make people just instantly believe that this is somehow better when they have absolutely no proof that, in fact, it's better, although we do have proof, in fact, that they're worse.
Could you talk a bit about that proof?
Well, I mean, I guess it's anecdotal and qualitative feedback that they're worse, but, like, for example, when I said that, you know, the proficiency level for children in New York State have dropped, we've got anecdotal story from teachers and from children ripping their hair out in tears and frustration over trying to understand and manage their comprehension of these new standards, the way that math is done or the close readings that are attached to the language arts standards are frustrating children. They're frustrating teachers. There has not been a lot of success stories coming out of their implementation, but there's been a lot of failure stories and frustration stories coming out of their implementation. And you were asking about the Race to the Top funds, and I was mentioning those new evaluation systems, you know, the new requirements to shutter schools that are, quote-unquote, underperforming based on the new evaluation. And the other key component to the Race to the Top was the adoption of a new data collection or data infrastructure system, right, that they would add a whole new level or layer of technology. So for Maryland, they're going to require that all the tests be taken online. I'm pretty sure in Connecticut that's probably going to be coming if it isn't already.
Yes, it is. It's coming.
Yeah, and that's to manage the new rounds of data that are going to be collected, mined, and owned and managed in an effort to push forward all of these reforms. And so that leads into the testing.
Tell us a little bit about the testing and why you oppose the high-stakes testing.
Just a little bit. I'm going to read from this so that I standpoint. For one thing, it's not scientifically based. If you go back to the history of standardized testing in general, you really, really go far down the rabbit hole. You discover that around 1919, 1920 was the first time that standardized testing was implemented, and it was used during World War I and then into World War II as a way to test men in the military to determine who would go to the front lines, right? So it was an intelligence test used to determine who we were going to send off to kill and who would become a sergeant or whatever. And then we began to implement it into high schools in the decades following that. From its inception, it was determined to be culturally and racially biased. It was created by a gentleman who was associated with the eugenics movement. And yet we've ignored this for decade after decade. It's never been scientifically based in an ethical manner. We've known for decades that the biggest determining factor of how well somebody does on a standardized test is their zip code. And yet, in spite of that, we're leading with that as our measurement tool to determine how well teachers and students do. It fosters test-driven education that doesn't meet the individual needs of students. So when it's high stakes, when teachers' jobs are on the line, when schools being open or closed is on the line, you have test-driven education. And this, again, fosters more inequality. For students who historically do not do well on these tests for the reasons I mentioned earlier, in schools that are at risk of being closed or, you know, their teachers being fired, you have a greater loss of quality instruction. So, for example, in the city of Hartford, you're more likely to see skill drill and kill instruction, whereas out in Greenwich, you're going to have kids building rainforests and sitting in beanbag chairs. Well, what do you think, Johnny? Right? Because they're not at risk of losing their jobs. They're not at any risk. Those kids will test well. If you put them in a closet, they would test well. And so you're increasing the gaps of quality of instruction from low-income schools to high-income schools.
So instead of closing the achievement gap, we're going to be broadening it.
It widens it because you're driving it on a faulty premise to begin with. Mm-hmm. Saying we're going to close the achievement gap by testing them more is the most absurd statement ever to be uttered. And it's so profoundly cruel to the students, the parents, the teachers, and the communities who are being hurt the most by it.
Yeah, so this whole Common Core State Standards and the testing that goes with it is actually kind of a hoax on us as a way to take public money, put it into private hands. They don't really care what the effect they're having on students and teachers and education in general. It's all about the money?
That's it. Bingo.
Okay. Enough said. Okay.
I mean, that's it.
Yeah.
I mean, honestly, if you really research the people who have influenced the legislation that has led us here, Pearson Publishing Company, which has the lion's share of the testing and Common Core materials, back in 2010, 2011, even earlier than that, spent millions of dollars lobbying. Okay, they lobbied for the legislation to create new teacher evaluations and student evaluations at the federal and state level. Now, why would Pearson bother to do that unless they had a profit motive, right?
Right.
So, you know, on the other end of it, they have their hands out. You know, K-12 Inc., which I mentioned earlier, also influences policy. A lot of this policy has been influenced by organizations that are members of the American Legislative Exchange Commission. Now, they don't want to admit that because if you go and you visit ALEC websites, they say that they're opposed to Common Core. But if you look at the corporations that have funded and promoted this, an enormous portion of them actually are members of ALEC because from a business standpoint, from a free market privatizing standpoint, this is motivating for them.
And just for clarification, ALEC is the organization that recruits state legislators to take the legislation that ALEC has drafted and gets them to introduce it and promote it to state legislators around the country and ultimately to vote on that.
Correct. Behind closed doors, they craft model legislation that is to the advantage of the global multinational corporations.
And we've just been joined in the studio by Jonathan Pelto. Jonathan, welcome.
Thank you.
Would you like to jump in here?
I certainly would.
And Warner, on the issue of cost to taxpayers, the federal government, Bush administration, Obama administration will argue that they put forward record amounts of money to promote No Child Left Behind and Race to the Top, and yet in places like here in Connecticut, we've been unsuccessful in tapping into that money. In your studies, are you finding that the burden on the costs of going to this massive testing scheme is predominantly, is that money coming from federal, state, local level?
That's a great question. It's part of the Race to the Top initiative. The state has to agree to do all these things, and they get a certain chunk of money. And I think federal funding to public schools wavers around like 10%. I mean, the lion's share of it comes from taxpayers in the local districts. So of that 10%, they're going to give you a certain chunk of money to implement these things, but it's part of the stimulus package. We're going to give you this one-time money. Well, what happens when that federal money runs out, which it is for a lot of states already? It's already spent. The money's gone, and they haven't even completed redesigning the infrastructure necessary to the policies that they were forced to put into place. Now that that money's gone, who's going to bear the burden of the costs associated with these new policies? That's going to trickle down to the taxpayers. We're not going to be able to sustain these new infrastructures, the $50 million Maryland's going to have to pay to buy the new Common Core-affiliated textbooks, the $100 million for the infrastructure for online testing. The federal money for that's already gone or close to being gone, so who's going to pay for that? It's going to be you and me. And the states are going to collapse under the weight of those costs.
Morna, can you talk a little bit about teacher evaluation and what you think that will do to the teaching profession and to education in general?
Without expletives?
No, we can't say them on the air. So, yeah.
Well, I mean, I think you can see the damage that was wrought from No Child Left Behind on teachers and the teaching profession is even far greater. And it's part of this bigger narrative. I don't know if you've seen it yet, but you're going to see it. Time Magazine. Jonathan put this on Facebook. Time Magazine's front cover. Do you want to describe it, Jonathan? Because you can do it better than I can.
So Time Magazine has a front cover that, for all intents and purposes, defines teachers as being creatures of tenure, of lifetime employment, and that there is no mechanism to get rid of those bad teachers. And so rather than discuss the complexity of the due process rights that public employees have, they just have bought into that on the bandwagon of simplifying it by simply saying that all teachers are basically in it for their lifetime employment, and there's no mechanism to get rid of bad teachers, which, of course, is not true under any
right.
circumstances.
Right. And, you know, running with the narrative, the power of suggestion, oh, teachers are bad. Oh, you know, if the first sentence you see in the front of that magazine is bad teachers, not how do we keep good teachers, that wasn't it. It was getting rid of bad teachers. It's very clever marketing. So the word you walk away with as a reader is bad teachers, bad teachers. Now you pair that with what the new testing is going to do to test scores, what it's going to do in the classroom. Those teachers are going to come out, a lot of them, looking as if they are not doing their job. And so if you take the test scores that are going to be coming out with the new Common Core in the next couple of years, and you pair that with the narrative of bad teachers, bad teachers, bad teachers, you've got the perfect storm to erase the profession as we know it.
And it looks like every problem we have in education is because we don't have good teachers and we can't get rid of them.
That makes me so furious, because what it does is it's a bait and switch, or waving the shiny object in front of the public. And what we suggest, especially in communities that have historically been underserved or have struggled to have good public education systems, we blame the teacher, right? We blame the teacher for the failure of the child rather than blaming the society that has failed the children in those communities for decades. So rather than really addressing the problems, which are systemically economic and racial and cultural, socioeconomic at their core, we've been failing these communities historically. And yet we're going to blame the teacher that's doing her best to try to turn that around, but we're going to tie her hands behind her back while doing so, knowing that these kids are not going to perform well in those tests to begin with.
I think that's especially true in places like Connecticut, where we have this tremendous gap between wealth and poverty. Connecticut, the proponents of the corporate education reform industry, talk about the achievement gap and how we need to address that. But of course, we also have the country's largest wealth gap between the rich and the poor. And the studies that I've seen, and Warner, maybe you've had access to more of those, is that the primary factors that lead to test scores are poverty, language barriers, and the lack of special education services, and that somewhere that teacher impact at the individual level is, at least the academic studies seem to show, somewhere between 6% and 10% at best, and that doesn't even deal with the fact that you're then being tested on students that you had no impact on for the first 2, 3, 4, 5, 10 years of their educational
right.
experience. So that, in fact, all of this spending and all of this effort to evaluate teachers based on test scores is at best less than 10% of the factor that would go into how well a student does in those tests.
It's a disingenuous narrative that really, it cloaks the attack on urban public schools as remaining public. The way I frame it to people on the simplest level is, have you ever seen a failing school in a wealthy community? Is it really that those teachers are just magically all better? Or is it that those kids are magically all just brighter? Or is there something else? I've never seen a school shuttered in a wealthy neighborhood. Never.
Do you think under No Child Left Behind, they were able to get a lot of the urban schools to fail, and as you said, not the wealthier districts? But do you think now under Race to the Top with the Common Core and the new testing, that it's designed to get at the more affluent communities also?
Well, I think what they're going to do is for the urban communities that are, these are the new colonizers. They're going to sweep through urban landscapes and privatize public education against the wishes of the public, because a lot of those parents and children and teachers are fighting back to save those schools, the public schools. And then in the suburbs, like where I live, for you it would be, you know, I don't know, Darien, Greenwich, you know, other neighborhoods like that. When those children start to perform more poorly on the new test, those parents are going to race out to buy the new test prep material, the new tutorial services. There are companies out there now already saying, we've got the latest Common Core materials. We can help your child perform well. Because those are the kids who are going to go to college. And if they're at risk of not performing as well as they did before, the parents are going to spend money hand over fist to get their kids back up to the level that they think they need to be at. So it's a money-making industry for those who have money, and it's a way to colonize, privatize, and destroy public education for those who don't.
That's really an outstanding portrayal of the issue, because it's a win-win situation for the corporate education reform industry, in that they either get absolute control of the schools, and so they're private companies that are engaged in public purpose, or they just simply make a lot of money. In my suburban community, you say that the parents will come out, and I think you're right, but in many cases, the superintendent and the school district will take whatever steps are necessary. So in my town, they've already purchased software that they intend to have the students take 8 times before they take the Common Core test.
Bingo.
And that test actually doesn't cover the content. It covers the technique for taking the Common Core test, so that it will determine which kids need typing support, which kids need support.
I wonder how much that costs.
Right.
How much does that cost?
I think it's called the STAR software, and what's happened, this is the first year they're going to use it. They tested it last year. So then they'll break out the children who need, quote-unquote, extra help with typing or extra help with using that complex software that, in our case, the SBAC, the Common Core test, allows you, for example, to highlight passages. Well, what they found was, of course, the kids don't take the time to highlight the passages because they can't figure out how to use those tools on the computer. Whereas on the old system, the paper system, they had the paragraph right there to read. So now you are going to have wealthy towns that are going to, quote unquote, beat the system by buying into the system, but they have the resources to do that, and the kids will look like they're from Lake Wobegon. They're all going to be above average, and they're going to be above average because they were trained to take a test in addition to having, as you said, because of their affluence and lack of language barriers and special education supports, they were going to do better on those tests anyway. Now they're really going to do better because they will have been trained in order to jump through that small
right.
hoop called
right.
the Common Core test.
And if we blame the teachers, if that narrative is the predominant one in the mainstream media, which apparently it is, nobody's going to question when we shutter those schools in low-income neighborhoods and flip them into charters, because it's going to be assumed that that's better, when in fact the research has already shown that 37% of those charter schools that replaced the public schools perform more poorly than the schools they closed. But nobody wants to talk about that, because then they can't move forward.
Now, Morna, let me ask you, getting back to teachers for a moment, new teachers, it's sort of new here in Connecticut, the Common Core, so we may not have data here, but is there data, are you aware of data from other states where anything about new teachers just can't make it because of the stress that all of this puts on them?
I think it's a more complicated narrative for teachers because some of them that I've spoken to like it. And it's not that they're not good, caring, you know, involved teachers, like, oh my God, what's wrong with you? It's depending on the standards that are being replaced. So for some states, some of those Common Core standards might seem better. They might be better. I think you have to look at the case-by-case specific to the classroom, the community, the grade level, all, you know, the subject area. And so I was like, yeah, but you got to zoom out. If they were so good to begin with, then detach it from all of this other stuff. I think some teachers are ripping their hair out and frustrated and feel hamstrung by it. Other teachers would tell you that they like them. And I think those teachers, like most of us, aren't aware of what the bigger implications of all of this are going to be. They're just looking at teaching math strategy A or teaching math strategy B. Well, I like strategy A. That happens to be Common Core. And if that's all you ask them, they might say that they like it. But if you said, do you know it's attached to all these other things? If you've listened to this radio show, do you still like it? They're going to change their minds.
But what about in terms of the evaluation? Is the evaluation getting rid of new teachers faster, you know, based on the test?
I don't have any research to that, but it sounds like a predictable outcome.
Right. And, you know, in Connecticut, we have a longer period than most states before you get tenure. There's actually 4 years. In California, the decision in that case to knock down tenure was what people haven't talked about, is there was a series of complexities associated with that particular case. And so even though the multimillionaires are now trying that case in lots of places, New York and others, it's not the same situation because there, I think it was 18-month period before getting tenure, there were a variety of other issues. Here it was 4 years. The claim that teachers were not being appropriately evaluated was as much a commentary about the lack of training and will among administrators to work with new teachers and determine which ones really weren't appropriate for the classroom. And so the idea of either doing away with tenure or simply shifting to using the tests as the mechanism to determine who's good and who's bad skips over the whole notion that administrators need to be trained as supervisors and evaluators and supporters of their teachers in order to determine which ones are capable and which ones probably should find another career. But it just seemed a lot easier, I think, to the political people of let's just overlook that and simply put in a test as opposed to actually requiring that school administrators conduct the kind of evaluation programs that would make a difference, as if, you know, there are plenty of models around the country where they have very good teacher evaluation programs in which they don't have it associated with standardized test scores. And if there's any evidence, the evidence is that those tend to do a better job of determining which teachers need extra help or even which teachers shouldn't be in the classroom to start with.
What it will do, and if you eliminate tenure, you have a far more compliant and terrified body of people in the teaching profession. I mean, it's even possible to be more terrified and compliant than teachers already feel forced to do. But you pair that with Common Core, we're deprofessionalizing, we're dumbing down the experience of teaching from being a complex art that requires a skilled professional to one that, going back to my story about the first time I cracked open the Basel reader and it gave me a script and I closed it and said, well, that's stupid. Why on earth would I need a textbook company to tell me what to say to the children that are right in front of me? We're going to have a whole generation of teachers who can't teach unless the script's been handed to them.
And one other topic I wanted to ask you before we get into the United opt-out and what that's all about is the tests themselves, the SBAC test. They're computer adaptive, so
could you address your experience with students taking this test? What's it like for them?
Well, what I've heard is experiences of children trying to take the test, even though they say it's adaptive, so many children, with or without special needs, have found manipulating the technology very difficult. They've struggled to, whether it was like the click and drag something, but the click and drag didn't work on their computer, or because of some fine motor skills or, you know, visual acuity skills, they couldn't do it correctly. To trust a computer to individualize the learning experience for a child is absurd because it's a computer. It's got so many glitches, even in the way that it's constructed or created. As much as they're trying to promote this as being something that individualizes education and then put it ironically into a standard format, it's a failed experiment. I don't think they've ever proven that it's an accurate, viable, ethical way to measure anybody.
Morna, you're part of the United Opt-Out campaign. Maybe you could tell us about why you believe that parents should opt their children out of these high-stakes tests.
United Opt-Out started in 2011, right on the heels of the Save Our Schools National March and Call to Action down in D.C., and some of us intersected with each other during that time, helping to organize that event and getting to know each other. And Peggy Robertson reached out to me, Tim Fleckar, Seresta Smith, Lori Murphy, Sean Johnson, I think we're the original six, and said, I would like to start a Facebook site that is dedicated to helping parents opt out of standardized tests. And my first thought was, oh, how cute, Facebook. Okay, sure, sounds great. I'll help you with that. I had no idea what I was getting into. And within 48 hours, we had, you know, like 700 members. It just took off. And it's just grown since then. It's grown into not just helping parents understand how testing hurts their child, but how this is influencing the face of public education as we know it. So our primary goal is to provide state-by-state opt-out guides or testing refusal guides so parents have the tools to refuse the test. We've got one-page flyers with talking points, you know, why standardized testing is harmful to their child, as well as to their teachers and to their schools. And we try to provide support. So if anybody emails us or texts us or goes on Facebook and needs help at a local level, we try to coordinate them with other people in their area. Or we try to bring national attention to something that's happening locally. Because it's very hard as a parent to feel like you're the only one that's doing this, or that if you do it, your child will be negatively affected. It's really important that we have that solidarity. And the reason that we argue for opting out is not only to help my own individual child not be subjected to that, which is part of it for me, it's fully understanding that the way to stop this entire crazy train in its tracks is to deny them the data. Every parent refused or opted their child out this spring and said, you know what? No, I'm not doing it. If every parent or enough parents did that, the whole reform crazy train that's destroying public education would stop, because they need that data to drive it forward. That's where the money comes from. It's where the power comes from. It's where their excuse to do everything that they're doing comes from. So you just refuse.
And have there been any repercussions for people who have refused?
On an individual level, I've heard of parents being given grief by administrators, forcing their child to sit and stare at the test, or telling them they have to stay home, or calls to social services for the child's increased absenteeism. Lots of bully tactics. But when push comes to shove, the legal right rests in the arms of the parents. It's their legal right to refuse these tests without a detrimental effect to their child. So what we have to do is support parents who are being bullied. I don't know of any school that's been denied funding as a result of refusing the test, because that's the other thing they'll tell you as well. If we don't test, you know, we won't get the funding. I don't know of any school that's been denied funding because the parents or the children refused the test. I don't know of any school that's been shuttered as a result of refusing the test, but I can list off at least a dozen that have been shuttered because they took the test and failed. So, You know, as much as I think parents and teachers are afraid of the effects that will be felt if they refuse the test, so I just keep coming back and saying, really, do you have anywhere to go but up from here?
Here in Connecticut, the effort to mislead or even lie to parents has been truly astonishing. Last year, where there was the first year of the testing of the CBAC, a smarter balance test, the superintendents of the various school systems were given a memo and a letter to send out. The memo and letter coming from the Commissioner of Education, who actually laid out the ways in which they should mislead parents into believing that they did not have the right to opt out. So it said, if the parent says this, you should say that. If the parent says this, you should say that. In the final paragraph, it did say that there was no law that forced the parent, nor any punishment that could be brought against the parent or the child, but that in all of the material, and most of the superintendents used that memo or used that letter, and in the letter, it actually said that parents do not have the right to opt out their children, even though the memo that went with the letter said that they do. And so this bullying tactic, as you describe it, I think is exactly that. And then the second piece, that somehow if you don't have 95% of the students taking the test, you'll lose your funding. There are, of course, hundreds, thousands of schools that don't reach that 95% goal for any number of reasons, tend to be those schools in poor areas or in areas with high language barriers. But that when we see the federal government trying to take money away from states it has to do with the more basic levels of the NCLB and the race to the top. I agree with you. I've never heard that Ernie Duncan or any of the people at the federal level have suggested that a school would actually lose funding. Where those discussions are taking place is where Vermont or Oregon have simply said, we are not going to participate in these broad areas of the race to the top.
Right. I mean, they have them scrambling for pennies, is what it feels like. Well, we'll lose the money. I mean, what are you going to lose? You're going to lose money to pay for the infrastructure for the tests, which if you didn't have them in the first place, you wouldn't need the money. It's not like you're going to be losing an art classroom. The race to the top money is specified particularly for the new reforms. If you reject the new reforms, you don't need the money. It's like getting a coupon to buy Pearson products. The problem is, if you get a coupon for something like, you know, get $20 off when you spend $50, you've got to go spend the $50. And that's how they've got public school systems to buy into these partnerships with these private corporations and then get the discount, which is the race to the top fund. But the other thing is with the 95% refusal rate, is if you have 6% or over refusing the test becomes null and void. You can't use that number to determine anything because you don't have enough of a sample to prove its reliability or validity.
So we wouldn't need large numbers to actually be doing this to thwart this whole effort.
It's got to grow in numbers. And I know that parents are understandably worried about the effects to their child or just being that parent, right? I'm kind of comfortable with it now. I'm like that parent in my school. But it's hard. But I think more and more parents are reaching that breaking point. When you hear about kids in kindergarten and first grade going into school in diapers because they can't leave the testing room to go to the bathroom, it's,
wow.
You've hit a breaking point. You know, you've hit a turning point where refusing the test is the least of my concerns. More and more parents are hitting that breaking point.
Mona, can you talk a little bit about how someone can opt a child out? I know you have forms on your website, or how they go about this?
Yeah, I would go first and foremost to your state guide on our website and connect with other parents and teachers in your district and in your state, because the ins and outs of it depend on the state. In New York, they have a testing refusal code 999, if I'm remembering that correctly. But in Maryland, we don't have that. If you ask to opt your child out of testing in the state of Maryland, you're going to get a letter from MSCE that says, I'm sorry, we have no opting out policy. And a lot of parents go, oh, see, I tried. I'm like, no, let me rephrase that for you. I'm refusing the test. And so your language is really important depending on the state that you're in. In Maryland, you have to refuse the test. There is no opt-out clause. My suggestion is go through your school first, because when push comes to shove, it's going to be determined by your district officials, you know, your school principals, your county superintendent. And again, that's just for Maryland. I don't know what it might be for Oregon. They might have slightly different chain of command. But I went through the school. I went to my teacher. I said, look, this is what I'm doing. This is why I'm doing it. So that they knew that I was really trying to support them. I wasn't trying to make their life miserable. I gave them the letter. It went to the principal. MSDE tried to push back with me. I was like, go ahead. I double dog dare you. Let's play chicken and see how this turns out for you. They backed off. And my school conceded to the request and was very, very supportive of me, as a matter of fact. But that's not always the case. So the best thing you can do is know your state policy, your district policy, and get support at the local level from other parents.
Yeah, to do it in a group would be much, much better.
Get advice from people who know, oh, you need to go to so-and-so. It's really specific.
And would it be important to ask also the school what the arrangements they're going to make for your child while the other students
Right.
are taking the test, so they're
Right.
not forced to sit there? And
well, that's the bully tactic. That's mm-hmm. bully tactic number one, that your child will be forced to sit and stare, in which case you can say, first of all, show me in writing where it says that you can compel my child to do that so I can show it to my lawyer. That works really well. And then push back on those bully tactics. You know, you have the right to request that your child be doing some other meaningful activity, whether it's reading in the library, helping with the kindergarten class, if like they're in fifth grade, or sitting in with another class, which is what my child did. He sat in with another class that wasn't testing that day.
Here in Connecticut, we saw that variation across the state, and it really was dependent on the superintendent and the school administration and whether or not they were going to willingly accept that parents had that fundamental right. And so in some towns, places like Madison, Connecticut, small coastal town, suburban town, the children had no problem. They were allowed to go to the library. In some of our other communities, particularly in some of the bigger cities, they were forced to sit in their seat while the testing was going on, but were not forced to take the test. And then we even had a number of schools that told the parent and the child, just log on to the computer, and then you don't have to do anything more. but they wanted to get to the 95%, even though the score would be a zero and bring down the average. So it just showed the absurdity of and the power of that, the lack of will on the part of some of these local administrators to stand up for their children and parents, and instead they had been deputized as bullies for the State Department of Education, and they chose that course instead of Superintendent of Madison, Connecticut, being one who openly talked to their parents about that they did have the right and that any parent who wanted to do that, they would be welcome to. So I think you're absolutely right that parents need to be prepared to be bullied, and that it's a lot easier to stand up when you've got more than a single parent, when you have a group of parents that are willing to work together.
And it's a lot easier, from what I understand, for parents in upper middle income communities. And I've heard that a lot. Well, it's easy for you in the suburbs to opt your child out, but if we're in an economically strained community, you know, rural or urban, the losses to us are more tremendous. That's a privilege of the white soccer moms to be able to opt out. We can't do that. And I really empathize with that. I mean, I really do. And I think that their concerns are incredibly real. But if you zoom the scope out just a little bit and you realize, you know what, a lot of those communities, they're gunning for you anyway. They are going to, by hook or by crook, make sure that your children fail and your school closes. It's a stalling tactic. I think a lot of parents still think, or teachers think, if I just play by the rules and I do what they say, they'll leave me alone. And I'm damn sure that that's not going to happen, because their agenda is to take those schools. So the misassumption that if I just play by the rules and do well, they'll leave me alone, I think sadly is a mistaken one. I think they're screwed anyway.
So perhaps it could be some kind of a group effort between the suburban and the urban schools to do this together.
Yeah, I think we need all kinds of partnerships.
Jonathan, as we approach the end of the hour, is there anything that we haven't discussed that you'd like Morna to address?
Well, maybe if you could just go back to the fundamental issues of why are these standardized tests deemed inappropriate and or ineffective. I know that before you had mentioned developmental issues about whether they were appropriate, and then the structural issues about what really influences standardized testing. But maybe you could sort of walk the audience through why shouldn't we just go ahead and suck it up and say, my kid needs to be tested against every other kid in the same exact way.
Right. If we circle back to the two things you mentioned, one, the history of standardized testing going back to the eugenics movement, that it's always been about race and class and ethnicity from its very inception. It's never been a fair measurement of anything other than your zip code and your culture and your economic status, your proximity to understanding the cultural norms that are embedded in the tests themselves. Secondly, that they are developmentally appropriate, that they ask children questions, especially at the younger grades, that are not suited to those grades. If you layer on top of that the new pressures, you get the pressure to cheat, which now we can't really rely on that, because how do we even know if this is an accurate measure, because there may or may not have been cheating going on when they're done on the computer, and you now have all kinds of infrastructural problems. You know, oh, we couldn't get online today, and we lost all of our data, right? There are so many problems at every layer of standardized testing, and they're piling on top of each other at an exponentially increasing fashion the more we ramp them up to younger grades and now online and more frequently and more complicated. The number of reasons that we cannot use these in any reliable way to do anything have grown as well. I don't think there's one argument anybody could make using education, science, or qualitative studies to document that this makes any sense at all. Does that answer the question? Sometimes I feel like I go in circles.
No, I think that did an excellent job. And what we're all learning as we come to grips with these standardized testing is that the underlying reason that it's here is that privatization effort that you mentioned. Many of us took the SATs or other tests thinking, you know, well, that's what we needed to do to get into college. And in Connecticut, we have had a long history of something called the Connecticut Mastery Test, which generally is a curriculum test about what is being learned at that grade level. So the notion that somehow this is different, it takes a while, I think, for parents to fully understand that, you know, there's nothing fundamentally wrong with standards, although why you would have exactly the same standards everywhere is counterintuitive, because if in Connecticut our lowest performing students score better than the average students in Mississippi or Louisiana, Louisiana and Mississippi may want to look at improving their standards, but in fact in Connecticut some of the standards are better, some of them are not as strong as the Common Core. But we should be able to develop those standards based on the issues that are important to us. And so the notion that, okay, is it just wrong to have standards? And the answer is no, there's nothing wrong with having standards, but they have to be relevant, age appropriate. Where you get into what's wrong is then using this system, which is really geared for certain people to make money, but also, quite frankly, a system that's designed to produce an entire generation of students who have been told that they are failures. That evidence in New York was, you know, so disturbing, where you're now having multiple years of students being told they're failures, when in fact it's because if they had really meant those standards to be important, they would have phased them in over 10 years or 15 years and then started the testing down the road. But instead, they wanted those students to fail. They wanted to be able to say 97% of bilingual students fail, so that then there'd be no doubt that the solution was somehow simply to take those schools and those children and hand them over to a private company to conduct their education.
Yes, standards are only as good as the way in which you measure them. Right? And so if this is our way in which we're going to measure how children learn, we're failing them at the outset because it's a failed system of measurement. And I think it's important to note, too, that the bigger picture, as Jonathan said, is privatization. I think when you look at the resistance to Common Core across the board, you know, in different states, there's some good information, and I think there's some misinformation. And some of that comes from, well, these are national standards. Therefore, they're trying to nationalize us like China. This looks very communist. This is like socialized. And that doesn't work for me when you peel back the layer of that appearance and you see that the people who have constructed this are multinational global corporations who embrace a free market enterprise because it's profitable to them. That this is about privatizing education through a nationalizing of it. It's much more of an oligarchy than it is any other enterprise.
Jonathan, I just wanted to ask you one last question. Governor Malloy is a big proponent of the Common Core State Standards, and the CEA has endorsed him, and I know they've received some money, I think, from the Gates Foundation. So I wonder if you could just talk about that a minute.
Yeah, and, you know, it's one of the issues that has increasingly been brought up, and that is the oligarchy reference. They have done a spectacular job of buying up support. And so not only did the Gates Foundation and the Walton Foundation and the Broad Foundation really fund the development of the standards and the pressure on the tests, but then they also went out and they bought up the public relations operations and all of the constituencies that might be able to or willing to have stood up and challenged it. So, for example, significant amounts of money going to the American Federation of Teachers, the National Education Association, the PTO associations. And so what you have is, under the guise of, we will give you this money if you will go out and educate people about the benefits of the Common Core, we're now seeing people start to backpedal, both the unions and some politicians. But one of the reasons that we find ourselves in the position that we're in is that the Gates Foundation and the others really had bought up the constituencies that should have been more vocal and articulate on behalf of teachers and parents and students. It's interesting that in Connecticut, we have a Democratic governor who is full on board the Common Core and recently said it was just too late to turn back. Next door in New York, the governor had said something very similar just a few months ago when Cuomo said there's no turning back. And yet he's now running television ads that are saying that if he's elected, he will push off the Common Core for at least 5 years and will only implement it if the teachers and students are ready. So I think what we're beginning to see is that the more astute politicians are realizing that while the bread is buttered on the side of being for the Common Core, that when it comes to campaign donations, when it comes to votes, they need to start to distance themselves. And certainly Andrew Cuomo has done that. We haven't seen that yet here in Connecticut.
We haven't seen it in Maryland. Our state superintendent of schools, Lillian Lowry, is an Eli Broad scholar. And she's also on the governing board of PARC. And what you begin to see are these lines of influence behind closed doors that shape the things that we're seeing pushed through. And the only way they succeed is that they're paid for advertisement. It's like that, if you ever read a magazine and something is an advertisement, but it looks like it's an article, and then you go all the way down to the bottom and it's like paid for by the blah, blah, blah company. You know, that's Common Core. You can go to what seems like a legitimate educational website that's promoting Common Core, and here are all the things that you, the tools for a teacher's success. If you go all the way down to the bottom, there's that little paid-for advertising logo, paid for by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation or the Broad Foundation or Common Core or Achieve. They have to rely on advertising because they don't have the research to support them.
Well, unfortunately, we're out of time. Maureen McDermott, I really want to thank you for being on the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
And Jonathan Pelto, thanks again for coming on the show.
My pleasure.
And again, you were just listening to an interview with Morna McDermott, one of the co-founders of United Opt Out, and Jonathan Pelto, founder of the blog Wait, What?, that covers politics and education in Connecticut. And he's also a former state legislator. I want to encourage you to check out the UnitedOptOut.com website. There are lots of resources there and forms to help with opting out your own children from the high-stakes testing, if you choose to do so. And here's a partial list of some of their demands from the website. It says, high-stakes testing functions in opposition to quality public education, as it is used to punish children, to malign educators, and to provide financial gain for testing corporations and their political sponsors. Therefore, we demand an end to the following. All high-stakes testing and punitive policies that label schools, punish students, and close public community schools. All high-stakes testing that ties teacher evaluations, pay, and job security to high-stakes test results. Corporate interventions in public education and education policy. Corporate-run, for-profit charter schools that divert public funds away from public schools. Mandates requiring teachers to use corporate-approved scripted programs that sublimate and negate authentic and meaningful learning experiences imparted by varied and rich curricula. On the website, they have a sample letter that you could use when opting your child out of the high-stakes testing. And here's what the letter says. Dear Principal, thank you for all that you do for my child and for our school. I'm writing to respectfully and formally inform you that my child is not to take any tests that will be graded or evaluated via computer or any source outside of his teacher who administers it. This includes the SBAC assessments. And SBAC is the Smarter Balance test used in Connecticut. It goes on to say, please note that this is not a request and that I am already aware that Section 10-14N of the Connecticut Education Laws mandates that each student annually take a statewide mastery examination. However, as you likely know, the Connecticut General Statutes also do not disallow parents' refusals, and I am therefore perfectly within my legal rights to do so. Please note that a refusal is not the same as absent, as they are defined differently. As such, my child will not be required to participate in any makeup tests. I will be informing my child that he or she is not to take online tests and that if he or she is given one, he or she is not to work on it. I would ask that the school please provide him or her with an alternative activity during the testing. However, I understand that an alternative activity is not required on the part of the school. So if you are unable to provide him or her with an alternative activity, I would ask that you utilize the provision of the testing program educator guide to the Common Core, which explains when students have completed their tests, that student may be permitted to read silently. Please confirm your receipt and understanding of this letter. So that's on their website if you choose to opt your child out. They also have a Facebook page where you can connect with other parents who are doing this also, so you might check them out on Facebook. And again, the website is UnitedOptOut.com. And now I want to talk a little bit about the organization called ALEC, which is the acronym for the American Legislative Exchange Council. And here's what they say about ALEC on the United Opt Out website. ALEC is not a lobby. It's not a front group. It is much more powerful than that. Their self-described mission is to promote free market, limited government, and federalism. Through ALEC, behind closed doors, corporations hand state legislators the changes to the law they desire that directly benefit their bottom line. Along with legislators, corporations have membership in ALEC. Corporations sit on all 9 ALEC task forces and vote with legislators to approve, quote, model bills. ALEC's Subcommittee for Education Policy promotes legislation that attempt to privatize public education, destroy unions, replace teachers with computers, and Teach for America temporary teachers, and use education as a form of corporate control and profit. Bill Moyers did a really good show on ALEC a few years ago, And you can see it by going to YouTube and searching for Bill Moyers and Alec. And here are a few other websites that are fighting this government and corporate-driven push to privatize public education for corporate profit. One is fairtest.org. Another is badassteacher.org. So again, fairtest.org and badassteacher.org. And then another one is dianeravitch.net. And that's Diane, and Ravitch is spelled R-A-V-I-T-C-H. So dianeravitch.net will get you her blog. And then dianeravitch.com is just her general website. She's the author of the great book, Reign of Error, The Hoax of the Privatization Movement and the Danger to America's Public Schools. It's a great book. I highly recommend it if you want to learn a lot more about what's going on in this privatization effort. And again, she calls it a hoax. And to follow what's happening in Connecticut in this effort to privatize our public schools, Jonathan Pelto's blog, Wait What, is a really good source of information. The Assault on Public Education airs on the last Monday of every month. This is the 9th edition of The Assault on Public Education. The previous 8 shows are archived on the website radioforall.net, and that's the digit 4, so radioforall.net. Once on the site, just type in The Assault on Public Education in the search box, and the show should pop up. And I'm going to close the show today with the first part of a song by Van Morrison called Educating Archie. And here it is. By the media. Yeah.